Welcome to the Downstairs Care Out There blog podcast. My name's Mitchell Thomas. I'm speaking today with JD Graziano from the United States. JD's got a bit of a story to tell us. I first met him on Twitter, and we got into a number of discussions about various things that we're going to explore further today. Welcome to the show, JD, and thank you for being our first international guest.
Oh, great. Thanks, Mitch, for having me. I'm really excited. It's been a while since I've been on a podcast.
Well, that's good. Well, this is the podcast that almost didn't happen, isn't it?
I mean, we
had a power outage and a flood get in our way, and then we finally managed to get our schedules together and work it out, which I'm really happy about.
Me too.
So let's just start a little bit with where you're from.
Okay. Well, originally, if you're at all familiar with the States, I'm from the middle of the country, from a state called Missouri. I grew up there and then went to college or university out west in the northwest part of the U.S. in Seattle, Washington, and spent 4 years there going to school and then another almost 3 years there as a professional mountain guide and ski patroller, and did a little work. Continued to work there, worked up in Alaska, worked down in Northern California, and then into Mexico. And then met my beautiful wife, and in school, we were together while I was doing this, but I was only home in the States like 10 days a month. So it was kind of hard to sustain a relationship. So from there, we moved to Idaho, and that's where I got out of the guiding and ski patrolling, and I moved into being a ground EMT, which here in the States is a basic level. So again, we kind of talked about this before we started. I'm not very familiar with all your levels, but to try to bridge the gap, it's a basic life support provider. So basic airway intervention, oxygen, CPR, assisting with medications. There are some medications it can give, but very few, like oral glucose, that kind of thing. They can assist with EpiPen, to name a few things like that.
Oh, lovely.
So I did that for some years, and then I went to paramedic school. But I guess I kind of jumped ahead because you wanted to hear more about the ski patrolling things.
Oh, we'll explore the EMT a little more, seeing as we're on that now, and we'll come back to ski patrolling. You've got far too many interesting things to say, and we're just going to go off on tangents all the time, I think.
Yeah, you're right.
So the EMT over in the States, that's your base level of provider over there.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. We have three levels. So we have the EMT, the intermediate, and then into the paramedic.
Lovely. I think having a look at where I lie on that spectrum, I would be kind of halfway between a paramedic and an EMTI. I mean, we can do a lot of pain relief over here. We can do a lot of cannulation. We can do LMAs, no intubation, and various other bits and pieces that sit in the paramedic domain. But we do have a higher clinical level above us that we call our intensive care paramedics. And they would be essentially a fully fledged paramedic level from the American perspective there.
Okay.
And your EMTs would be closer to our trainees, we call them.
Okay.
They're the people who start, they come off the street and they want to be a paramedic, and they go through the whole 3-year internal program with a service to become a fully qualified paramedic, which is where I sit now.
Okay, and then eventually you can move
to
the
move
intensive
up, yeah.
care.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's based on merit selection, and you've got to apply for that, and you get the job first, and then you get the training. If that makes any sense, you don't.
Yep.
The knowledge isn't a prerequisite to apply.
Okay.
So you don't have to have paramedic to apply for the intensive care paramedic position.
Yes. Okay.
Which is kind of backwards to the way you do it, I suppose.
Well, at one time, yes. But now the culture in some, I'm not going to speak to everywhere because I haven't worked all over the States. But the culture has seemed to shift from where back a few years before even I got into it, the EMT, most paramedic schools wanted to see an EMT having worked in the field for some time before they were accepted into the program, into the paramedic program. Now it seems that paramedic programs will take, as long as I go to school and get an EMT, I could kind of do the zero to hero thing, whereas I could just get my EMT and go right into paramedic school.
Yeah. Yeah.
See that? And not ever have worked in the field, which, you know, there is some argument out there for pros and cons for that. But that's a whole nother, we could do a whole nother podcast.
We could definitely do a whole nother podcast on that. We've got the same issue over here, of course, with our graduates and our vocational entries. So let's talk about ski patrol. That's a job that there are probably about 40 positions for in Australia, so no one knows anything about it.
Okay, yeah.
Due to our lack of skiable surfaces.
Right. So let's see. I did it on a volunteer level to start while I was going to school in Seattle. And then my last year at school, that winter I transitioned from the volunteer position into a full-time. I worked at a small, very kind of what I would refer to as a grassroots resort, very much of a throwback. But if you ski, have any knowledge of skiing at all, it would hold up to any of the big kind of well-talked-about places in the States like Aspen, Jackson Hole, even in Canada, Whistler, those kinds of places, to kind of give a spread of if someone's listening to this and they have some skiing background. The terrain is very much comparable to that, just not as well known. It's kind of a local area, but very very well run. So the volunteer staff came in on the weekends only to supplement the professional staff, so they could, the professional staff worked through the week, and then they could drop down, they could cut the professional staff over the weekends to kind of help them rest and give some days off. It was a five day on, two day off rotation, so it wasn't necessarily Monday through Friday. You still had to pull a weekend duty. We did control work, so throwing explosives for avalanche control, which is a really fun part of the job.
Now you've got to do it the way the Italians do it. I think they fire howitzers into the side of mountains.
So certain
got to step up your game.
Areas, yeah, right. Certain ski areas in the States still do that, but very very few. And then, of course, actually, a lot of those areas recall the U.S. government, due to our involvement in other parts of the world, actually recalled some of the howitzers that had been placed at some of the other resorts. We had towers left over from when the 4 years ago when the resort first started, that had a couple, one or two howitzers mounted on, but they haven't had that for many years. So we carried it's been a while. We used to fill milk jugs full of AMFO, which is the same stuff that they basically fertilizer and diesel.
Yeah.
We fill those with milk jugs, full of those 1 gallon milk jugs. And then we would electrical tape a 1 pound charge to that, and we would either put those on bamboo poles and ski them out into the middle of slopes, or we had very rudimentary tram systems that we would climb up in a tree and hang them on the tram system, light the fuse, and then quickly manipulate the tram to get it out over the slope that we would want it to go off over, but you would have to stand and hold on to the tree while it went off, which was a which was quite an experience at times. And then we carried a bigger charge that looked like a basically, for lack of a better phrase, but it was a large tube, yellow, And we would throw those, or we would link those together, and have if we needed multiple charges to go off. So that was a good part of the job. It was fun. It definitely keeps you on your toes, and obviously it's dangerous, and you have to be very professional at all times, and really communicate. Requires a high level of communication. But that's really where I got my first taste of medicine, because I had to. I got a wilderness EMT. The explosive part was the fun, you know, the real, I guess, sexy part of the job, if you want to say. But you also, I mean, day-to-day operations is taking care of people. We had one of the fun parts about our mountain or our vantages is during the week we had paramedics and physicians that would actually ski just as the skiing public. They weren't dressed in uniform. But they carried a radio. So if we had a cardiac arrest on the mountain, we actually had advanced life support packs placed at various points in the mountain. They could get those. If we had shoulder injuries, the physicians could reduce the shoulders, that kind of thing. Because it was very hard. You know, in the Northwest, the weather is very wet. And flying is not always optional, and to drive an ambulance down takes a long time. And during the week, we did not keep an ambulance out of the behind the aid station at the base of the mountain. We had a small 6-bed clinic, very very rudimentary, but we had drugs there, we had pain meds, we had cardiac monitor. So there we could do. So I mean, even basic level suturing was done. At times, we had an avalanche dog one time that got cut on the leg by a ski edge, because sometimes the avalanche dogs run between your legs. On purpose, we have them run between our legs, but on occasion, they do take a nick. One of our paramedics started an IV on them and gave her fluids, and then sedated her a little bit because he was a medic in the special forces, so they get a little bit of veterinary medicine.
Yeah, yeah.
So we sedated her and then actually sewed her up right there. So it was a wide variety of and to take an 80-pound German Shepherd down on a toboggan.
That would have been
quite interesting while somebody's holding direct pressure on their leg. So, you know, usually we have people in there and we have a patroller holding this dog, and then and then we're trying to ski it down through some pretty interesting terrain. So that was kind of where I got that. So then I actually had a gentleman that I work with very closely there, who actually had done before he became a paramedic, he would split his time between New Zealand and the States. So he'd go to New Zealand on the off time, ski patrol there, and then he'd come back in the winter. So he basically was a patrolman all year round. But he became a paramedic in Washington because he, again, needed to make a little bit more of a living and was getting tired of that cyclical lifestyle like that. And he kind of took me under his wing and he taught my wilderness EMT class, and he's like, you really should think about going to paramedic school. So that's what kind of was the catalyst for the whole thing.
The whole journey.
Yeah. So I ski patrolled, and then I got involved with a local guiding service and did some more rescues on various mountains, and again, more basic level. Wilderness EMT kind of combines our regular EMT, as we were talking, with some a few more capabilities, like being able to clear C-spine in the wilderness environment, because obviously you don't want to have to carry some if you're way out and you don't have the proper equipment, or if it's just you and somebody else, you don't want to have to carry them. Yeah. And a few other things that kind of lended itself to the wilderness environment less, more than how am I trying to put this? Trying to bridge the wilderness kind of medicine to the street medicine little bit. So, so I did that, and then that was all great, and I kind of really enjoyed it. So and then as I said earlier, the guiding thing. I didn't do a lot of medicine with the guiding, a little bit here and there, but I did the guiding mainly in the summer. So the ski patrol was my winter gig, like many people kind of do in that profession. That's kind of the natural thing. until you get enough business as a guide, and then you kind of slowly, then you're able to provide enough work for yourself 365 days a year, which is hard. In the States, it's hard to do because it's getting better as a profession, but it's not quite all the way there. You know, I mean, we've joined the international community with the American Mountain Guiding Association, which has been huge. So they're taking big strides towards that, and it's getting there, but it's not still not what it is in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So I finally transitioned out of that. I went to paramedic school in Idaho. And right as I got done there, I worked as an EMT, I guess, on the ground for a hospital-based flight service. I worked with a critical care RN and myself, and we did interfacility transports on the ground, and then we supported the flight crews. If the weather was bad, we would go get them, or if a tertiary facility surrounding the downtown area needed a transfer of a patient, but it was too close for the helicopter, it didn't make any sense, or the ground ALS units that service the area, it was outside of what they were capable of providing, then we would go with them and take them. So I did that while I was going through paramedic school. And then we moved from out west to here where I currently am. And since 2008, I've been working for a rural paramedic service that has four ambulances. Two of them are staffed 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And the other two are backup trucks to those, and they are staffed on an on-call need, depending on how busy we get.
So the critical care transport is another thing that we don't do a lot of here in Australia. It's probably to do with our population being mostly coastal, and each of those coastal cities having a fairly capable high level hospital. So I was just wanted to talk a little more about that, and what did that entail? Was that taking people out of EDs to ICUs, or ICU to ICU, or a bit of everything?
It was everything from taking people out of EDs to doing mental health transfers. So patient comes into an ED and they need basically a psychiatric help, we would actually transfer them to a psychiatric care facility. So it was a good mix of everything. I mean, you'd have that all the way to, you know, your vented patient, multiple drips going. Obviously, I didn't handle that patient. The nurse did.
Yeah.
I would drive. But then when we assisted the flight crews, the nurse would sometimes be in the back if the nurse and the paramedic needed another set of hands, or I would be in the back. It just depended on what they needed, or we would both ride in the front. We were just the ride.
Yeah.
It kind of depended on the situation. But mainly for me on a daily basis, it was assisting the RN in doing interfacility ICU to ICU transports or ED. Like a small rural hospital outside of the city that we were in needed to bring a patient that walked into the ED, say that was really septic or something like that, and they needed ICU, we'd go out and get them and bring them back. So that's kind of – and then occasionally we would do 911 backup to the 911 service in the town if they got swamped.
Okay.
So it was a good range of everything.
Yeah, see, that's just a job that doesn't exist here. Basically, all of the inter-hospital transport, as we call it, is covered by our state ambulance service up to a point. If they're ventilated or require multiple high-risk medications or require RSI, obviously then the adult medical retrieval service for the state takes over. But things like mental health, we did a lot of mental health transfers. We did a lot of people out of ICUs into other ICUs that had maybe one or two medications running. Probably our most common one there was we would take people in in DKA to a step down ICU. Okay. So if they're coming out of a major ICU, going to one closer to home and things like that. But once again, we're talking about a completely different population size, I suppose. So
yeah, and we did stuff like that too. I mean, so it's there's some similarities there. And I worked, that's not, and again, one difference probably is that model that I was in is not a standardized model across the country.
Oh, okay. So that's just
you know what I mean?
Just a local solution.
Correct. There was also private, what we would term private services that do kind of do those non-emergent transfers as well, like saying somebody's post-surgical and they're ready to go back to a nursing facility. An ambulance service might come and take them back to that nursing facility. There's a lot of that from city to city, but hospital-based EMS services, some of them have their own 911 services that do transfers. This was an ambulance service that was pretty much, our model was pretty much interfacility transport, and then to support the pediatric teams, the OB teams, and then the adult rotor wing teams.
Okay.
As well. So, and that model is, there are, the, you know, we're not the only one, but it's not standardized across every state. Everybody has varying models of something like that, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Okay. And so paramedic school for you, what was that like? We had a little bit of a discussion about the differences between what we've both been through in that.
Yeah, so I went to a program in Idaho that's still there. It's a little, I think, morphed into something a little different than what I went to. But when it was first created by an ex-pararescueman, and he kind of took a little bit of their model for what they put their guys through for their paramedic portion of their training, and applied it to where I went. So it was very intense, and it kind of, as I explained to you, we did lecture in the mornings, probably almost every morning. We had a quiz of some sort, and then we would do lecture all day long, and then after our noontime, we would run scenarios all afternoon for 5 to 6 hours into the evening. And we actually, the program had a refurbished ambulance, so we could do we could actually drive around in an ambulance and kind of pretend work on the simulation dummy, and not pretend work, but use the simulation dummy to actually work on the patients. We would in the afternoon, we'd do mass casualties, so everybody in the class would get moulaged up. We'd pull our cars out of the parking spots, and we'd put them in various configurations, and we'd lay out in our hoods, and you know, put people out, and we'd get other people that had gone through the program would come in the afternoons and, you know, play patients. And we did this all afternoon, every single day, 5 days a week, over and over and over again, ad nauseum.
Practice and makes perfect.
Yeah. And it was, at the time, it was, at times it would be grueling, and we did things where, like, in the middle of the scenario, you know, we'd get questions. Like if I was working on a trauma patient, I would get medical questions asked to me while I was trying to work on the trauma patient. I was expected to take care of the trauma patient and answer the medical questions at the same time. So it was a lot of stress induced, kind of if Michael Loria is listening to this podcast, he's probably going to laugh, but I don't want to equate it to the same thing as what the pararescuemen in the Air Force here go through, but or any special forces. But it was an idea of inducing that kind of stress that we feel in the back trying to take care of somebody.
And I mean that has immense value to it. Just
yes, it does. I agree with you.
Feeling that stress before it's actually on you. For real, is of such a benefit to people. I know when I went through paramedics, I went through obviously a very, very different system to you. Mine was run on the university model, and ours was very, very touchy-feely, lovey-dovey, you know, adult learning. We're all happy students here. We didn't, mm-hmm. we did a lot of scenarios, but there was not a lot of quality feedback given. I do believe it has changed since I went through. They've changed instructors, and the new program is morphing into something absolutely amazing. But I know we went through kind of, I don't want to say easy, but you know, it was at that time where everyone, the model for giving feedback was not to criticize, but to try and build people up. And then doing the first year of that, and then going into the part-time military over here in Australia, was just an absolute culture shock in receiving feedback in two complete polar opposites. And I've got to say, I felt the way that the military here in Australia trained me to do a completely different job than paramedics, but mm-hmm. I felt that the stress is still the same regardless of where it's coming from, and that just the way we did that was much better. And I think that all paramedic students at some point in their program, if not at every point in their program, can benefit from some stress inoculation.
I agree with you. And the other thing that I really took away from my program is and then I've over the years, I mean, it was 2007 when I went through my program, but that I've seen from new paramedics that I've gotten to work with or that we've had in our field training programs that have come through, whether we hire them or whether they're just getting, you know, they're there to do their clinical time, is that I was stressed that make a decision and go, you know, if you're going to make a decision, do not just kind of make the decision and then kind of, you make a decision, you execute the decision, and if it doesn't work out, then make another decision to fix the previous one. If it didn't work out, don't kind of go into it with this, you know, wishy-washy attitude, because that will inevitably get you into a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe even more trouble. And I see that lacking in some of our education, at least in my area, because we do have university programs as well, and we have standalone programs in the States. I wish we could get maybe everybody onto the university idea so we could catch nursing a little bit and then attach it to a degree.
Yeah,
there are 2-year degrees out there, but I would love to see universities going to a 4-year paramedic degree. So again, that's a whole nother.
Is that degree a associate degree or?
Yeah. Right now, you can get an associate's in paramedicine. Okay. I have heard whispers there are some programs out there that are looking or have gone to four years, but they're kind of niche little programs. I don't know how true that is. I could be speaking completely out of turn because I don't follow it, but I have seen things, bits and pieces spread about here and there online that have said that they're trying to get those going or they are going. I had a 4-year degree going into my program, so for me it was really about getting the paramedic certificate.
Yeah.
It was not an associate's or something different was not really a concern, you know, wasn't on my plate, I guess.
Yeah.
So I got that, and then we moved from out there, and I came here, and like I said, I started working for that rural service, and over that time, I took the university where I am, I took their critical care course, which expands the scope of practice of the paramedic at that time.
Yep.
With the transition that the states have gone through now, it's the normal paramedic curriculum has kind of caught that. And then I did that because I wanted to become a flight paramedic. A little backstory on that is since 5 years, I have family in the East and part of the country, and I've been traveling out there. And since I was a little kid, I've watched Coast Guard helicopters fly over that area, and I've always wanted to fly in a helicopter as a medical personnel. So once I became a paramedic, I made that a goal And so when we came here, I started working on my critical care education, and then I self-studied and self-prepared and took the flight paramedic certification.
I've had a look at a couple of the flight paramedic preparation courses and some of the practice study questions, and that's quite a grueling exam.
I can't, obviously, I can only say for me, I thought at the time when I took it, there's two schools of thought here in the States. I think when it comes to that approaching that exam, some people have said to me, you know, because there's no actual flight paramedic course. I can't sign up and say I want to be a flight paramedic, and then I say I go to school for, I don't know, 6 to 8 months or a year, and then at the end, right? It's a certification exam for a basic level knowledge of critical care treatment.
So you have to self-study for that and then just attempt the exam off your own bat. There's not actually a preparation.
Correct. Now there are a few people out there that put on preparatory courses to take the exam, so you can go for 3 days, you know, and they go over the type of information that'll be in the exam, and then kind of how to take strategies on taking the test, right? But there's no actual. You can go. There's a university and some other people that are putting on critical care courses, which will get you critical care, and that kind of helps you take the flight paramedic exam. But there's no actual, to my knowledge, there's no actual flight paramedic course. It's just an exam, or like I said, the closest thing to it is the study prep. So I did one of those, which was very helpful. And if there's anybody out there that's thinking about doing it, I highly recommend doing one of them, because it was very beneficial to me, I thought. And so I took that, I passed it. I was not a flight paramedic, I was not flying at the time I took it. I kind of went down the road of I would like to get an interview, so I'm going to go ahead and obtain it. There are some programs in the States that are requiring it, either right off the bat or within a certain amount of hire time.
Yep.
Some of them would like you to have it.
Okay.
And then the other school of thought has been, go get a flight paramedic job, fly for a few years, get that under your belt, then go take the test. I just did it that way.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if there's a right or wrong way.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like there is.
No, it's just kind of how you feel. So.
Yeah. So obviously all the training for a flight paramedic comes from your critical care background and then what you learn once you're hired.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you kind of start, because like I said, the certification exam is as I understand it and believe it to be, is a base level critical care knowledge.
Okay.
Kind of like when you come out of paramedic school, you know all the things you know you know, and then you build on that knowledge as you practice.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then like we talked about before we started recording, a month after quite a journey, about in the first part of November, I accepted a position with a company as a flight paramedic, and so out west. So we're heading back to the Northwest. So pretty excited about that.
Oh, good. Good.
So it's a journey, and anybody that wants to do it in the States anyway, it is a journey, and don't get discouraged because it takes some time and definitely build on your everyday practice.
Yeah, because it all comes down to the basics, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, it really does. As much as we all want to do those really cool high-level procedures that we dream about doing when we go through paramedic school, and we think that every time we jump off the ambulance that we're going to be doing that. That really, in all reality, is not the.
Yeah, look, I can say what I've been practicing now for a year and a bit in the Army, and then I'm approaching a year and a half now with the state-based ambulance service, and you know, with all the time we spent training to put in LMAs and do airway management, I've probably done it about 40 times. And that's one of those sexy procedures that we all like, but we so rarely get to do. I think that's why we talk about them so much. We just want to live the dream.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and I think that I was thinking to myself, after I've gone through this whole process and made it to where I really want to be, I was kind of laughing because I think when we're younger, we're so excited and so eager, and after you get a little bit of time under your belt, and some guys out there in the Twitter world or the social media world have written some stuff about this and trying to get published about the experience versus the knowledge, and I'm not going to tackle that, but I have learned hard in a lot of experiences. There is a very big thing to say for the experience component and kind of the maturity level of the paramedic to be able to step into the flight role. Definitely, there are people that are super smart and haven't been doing it a while that probably could very well function in the flight world without any difficulty. But I think reaching that level, there is something to be said for that experience. And I would have been, after going through this process and finally getting hired, 3 years ago, I would have been right at the tip of the spear being like, you know, I've done all this education, I've done all this studying, and it's really important, and we don't recognize it enough, and I deserve to be there just as much as anybody else. But I think there is a certain level of experience that needs to go along with all of it. Again, just my personal opinion.
Yeah, no, so. I think I understand where you're coming from there. I mean, when I first came out of uni and went to work with my current employer, I felt, you know, 100% I was on top of everything. It was all good. I knew how to treat patients. I wasn't cocky or dismissive of anyone's experience, but I think the first 3 months kind of in that role showed me that, yeah, there is still a lot left to learn. And that's what you can't get from sitting in any course. I don't think there's no course that can give you just the knowledge that you can have from 5 years on an ambulance, or even 2 years on an ambulance, and I've already learned so much just in the way I approach everything and the way that we operate out here.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's not all after you've been on the rig for a while, you begin to learn it's not all about the clinical thing, because you find yourself in so many situations where you have to do the clinical side, but you also have to pay attention to constantly what's going on around you, and there's a certain flow that you of things, I think. I sometimes get on these philosophical tangents on Twitter where I kind of laugh at myself and it makes no sense, but there is a certain flow of how we do things in the field that I don't think you really get when you're in the classroom until you're out there and you
look
understand.
That was one of my biggest problems, was I just didn't know. Yeah, I didn't know when to stop with my patient. Like, I knew that the patient was in their house and they needed to get to the hospital, but everything between that was completely lost to me. Like, yeah, we've got to get a stretcher here somehow, and, you know, just maintaining. I can't remember who said it, but credit to them. Just maintaining the momentum of transport, I think I've heard it referred to as just, and that's that idea of just getting your flow and knowing that you need to do your primary, you need to do your secondary, but at the same time you need to be working towards that end goal of hospital where they can provide definitive treatment if you don't have that in the field.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you. You know, and sometimes it even comes down to the basic stuff where I've had new paramedics and I'm like, you really know and understand your stuff, but if you can't get the gurney out of the back of the ambulance or put it away,
that's a problem.
And you're gonna lose all the confidence in the family member if they're watching you try to fumble around with putting their loved one in the back of the rig. It doesn't matter if you can intubate a rock. If you can't put the cot or the gurney into the back of the ambulance.
Yep.
That's a, you know.
Yep.
So.
And that awkward bag fumble that every new paramedic I see does, they they just don't quite know where that one thing is, so they end up opening all four bags that we've brought onto scene and kind of standing in the middle looking like, where is, I want that one medication, like I want Ventolin, where's Ventolin?
right, exactly. And you're already stressed and you're, you know,
And you're not going to find that, like our Ventolin is a tiny little, it's a tiny little plastic polyampule that very easily hides, like four or five of them will slip down the side of a bag and they hide very easily inside our airway bag. So you've really got to know where everything is and develop that. I think probably the best thing I ever did was for my first couple of months in work, just looking at every bit of kit every day and just building that picture of where everything is. And it really comes into its own when you're, you know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you're trying to find a, you know, 18 or 16 gauge cannula on the side of the road in the dark. And you know, just by running your fingers along the cannula, the cannula bag, you know where that cannula will be. I mean, they don't teach that.
No, and that was something you and I kind of discussed with my program, was the repetition thing, to where you stop thinking about the skill.
Yeah.
Because it you know what to do. It just kind of happens naturally. So you can actually think about your treatment.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to think about doing the skill.
That's what you need. You need to just de-recruit that thinking part of your brain and focus it on where it needs to be thinking, rather than focusing on what you know you need to be doing, but you can't do because it's not there yet. And that's where, you know, that's where you had such a great advantage in all your simulation. The rest of us have just had to do it the hard way by doing repetition at the start and end of shift and doing it.
And I'm not, and by no means am I, advocating that my program was the best. It's just that I have going through my career and meeting lots of other people and other paramedics. And I just feel like that was one of the biggest things about all of that continual repetition over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Set me up, because, you know, I got, not in the States, not everybody's orientation program on the ground is the same. So my first job as a paramedic, that I found myself in a service that was like that. So, you know, it was, the orientation process as a third rider, as we would say here, was not long. And then I was on the ambulance with another EMT. So with no backup, you know, there were some interesting times in my first 2 years trying to work that out. You know, even though I had a wonderful, I went to downtown Atlanta, Georgia, which is if you're familiar with the States, it's a big metropolitan city, very busy, 100,000 plus call a year ambulance service. Very taxed ambulance service, so I got lots of experience in the time I was down there.
Mm-hmm.
So then to come to where I am now was a, you know, not nearly as many calls.
Yeah.
Different, just a whole different experience. I can remember the first day where I, the service where I just left. I can remember the first day working there. I got out of the ambulance. I drove to where we were going because I had to learn how to drive around the county. And I got out of the ambulance and I turned it off and I took the keys with me and I locked it. After we got the bags out, my partner looked at me and she was like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "What are you?" I said, "We're going inside for this call." And she said, "You just locked the car. You just locked the truck and you took the keys." And I was like, "Well, yeah." She's like, "You don't have to do that here."
Yeah, I do the same thing out here. I've just come from a very similar situation, like running 12, 10 calls a day. And now we're lucky to run one a day. Sometimes we'll have no patients in a day. And yeah, I still do that. I still lock the car and take away the keys and everyone looks at me funny.
Yeah, yeah. And it just, you know, they, when I was in Atlanta, they're like, "We've had ambulances stolen at the NARCs." And also, too, you know, I went into high-rise, gated high-rise communities there where, you know, you might be upstairs for a while because, again, you have to get creative with how to get those people out of there.
Yep.
And the ambulance is going to be sitting there for a while. You can't do that in some parts of the country. Whereas, you know, where I am now, we don't really have any, I don't work anywhere where there's a high rise.
Yeah, no, the largest building in my current coverage area is usually a grain silo.
Yeah, right, same here. Ours is corn. Corn.
we're wheat out here, so.
So, yeah.
Right. There's one two-story building in the whole town.
Nice. Right. Yeah. So you know exactly what I'm saying. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's just funny things like that, you know, that
So do you guys have a hospital in your county over there?
We do. It would be referred to as a critical access hospital.
Okay.
So the ED is 3 beds.
Yep.
Tiny. And it has about 15, the floor, so to speak, is about 15 beds. Maybe 18 beds. Yep. So not very big.
Yeah. So very similar to my local. Well, we've got a local district hospital. So that's pretty much the same as the critical access hospital. And that would be probably about the same numbers. It's got a 3-bed ED, 1 resus bed.
Yep.
And they can if the patient needs ICU, they have to be retrieved then or sent by ground ambulance depending on, or if they need surgery, they need to be sent. Yeah, they really don't do a lot, but
no, right. It's the same.
They provide that initial resuscitation and treatment that the patient needs, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's same with us. We could take them by, we would, depending on what the needs were, we would take them by ground or where I live. I don't live in the same county that I worked in. So where I live is the university town, so they have the big level one facility. And then there's another level two facility also in our town, where my wife works as a nurse. And, so they would send them, then we could call for a helicopter, which would come from here. Or there's a town to the north, city to the north that also has a helicopter. So either one of those two would come to the facility if they wouldn't go by ground, if the patient didn't go by ground.
Okay. So let's talk helicopter staffing. I don't think we've done that yet.
No.
So here in New South Wales, if I call for a helicopter, I'm getting a helicopter and a doctor and a paramedic. In the States there, it's very different from what I hear.
Yeah. So as we were talking about, across the country, there's different, there is, some programs, some of the university programs, you know, you could get a flight physician, a resident, either attending flight physician and a nurse, or a resident and a nurse and a paramedic. Here, I know the university, when you call them, sometimes they'll send you a nurse and a paramedic only, or the attending physician with the nurse and the medic, or you'll get a resident. The residency program, if you're getting an emergency physician classification, fellow, then you'll get a resident at times. The program I'm going to, they fly strictly nurse, paramedic. Other programs fly, you know, nurse paramedic or nurse respiratory therapist. So that's kind of how it goes in the States. But I think right now the most popular model is probably the nurse paramedic.
Okay.
Model.
So do you over in the States, do they do much fixed wing retrieval? That's a fairly popular mode of transport here in Australia.
There are some services, but the rotor wing aircraft is more popular.
Okay.
The distances covered are shorter.
Yeah.
So, you know, for the most part, I mean, there are services that are flying rotor fairly, you know, decent distances, but we have the program I'm going to, we have fixed wing aircraft. So I'll be doing both.
Oh, okay. So paramedic staff, your fixed wing.
Yeah. So the same crew that comes on for the rotor will also staff the fixed wing.
Okay. So here in New South Wales, we've got obviously the doctor paramedic model on our helicopters and on our aircraft routinely, it's just a flight nurse, and if they need to upskill it for a retrieval, then they'll get a doctor to come along, and it'll be a doctor nurse retrieval flight.
And there are some, and then there are, you know, there are fixed wing only programs here too in the States as well. Not everybody is a dual program, and they could have varying combinations as well. I'm not as familiar with the fixed wing only services. I just know with, at least with us and other local service where I am that I've flown with, it's generally been a nurse and a paramedic. And then of course where I'm going, it's nurse paramedic.
Okay. So with that, with your latest job, with the nurse paramedic helicopter, what's your primary role? Are you mostly based around interfacility transport, or are you involved more in primary retrieval, as in responding to the scene?
Yeah, well, I have to float. The company is broken up into regions.
Yep.
So I'm actually a float paramedic, so I will be floating between two bases, or sorry, four bases, two in one state and two in another. And so the reason why I say that is it's varying. One of the base may do, some of the bases may do more scene flights. Some of the bases may do more interfacility, but it just depends on where you are. But the aircraft do both scene flights and interfacility.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounded like it did.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that did make sense.
So I couldn't tell you which one, and I don't, obviously, because I'm new there, so I don't have enough knowledge yet to be able to say, well, this base I do 80% of the time I'm doing scene calls and 20% of the time center facility. It just varies between. So.
Yeah. So what was the other? I don't think we talked, we kind of skipped over, we were on a roll and we kind of skipped over the critical care paramedic role. Which is another thing that I wanted to explore, because once again, it's another job that we don't really have here in Australia. In my service, obviously, we've got our trainees, our qualified paramedics and our intensive care paramedics, but they stop short. Their skills are mostly related to moving patients to hospital. There's very little between hospital stuff that they do as their primary role. So what's the role of a critical care paramedic?
So right now, I think more in the States, more of the critical care paramedic is the roles seem to be outfitted for the interfacility transports from a ground side.
Yeah.
911, you know, I hold a critical care paramedic, but my service is not credentialed as a critical care service. So as far as delivering quote unquote critical care, it's going to be up to the each individual service. You know, there are some, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're governed by certain states rules. So like here where I am, one of the services I work for the other service I work for part-time basis has a LTV 1200. Or a critical care style ventilator, okay, or advanced ventilator, transport ventilator. According to the state rules, I cannot use certain modes of ventilation on a patient coming from the field. I can if they're coming out of an interfacility hospital. Yeah. So if I intubated a patient and I wanted to use certain modes of ventilation on them because I thought that was going to be better for them, I would literally have to go to a facility first, have them evaluated, and then as if it were an interfacility transport. Another example is that the critical care where I am can only do a surgical cricothyrotomy on an interfacility transport if your patient lost their definitive airway and you could not get them re-intubated.
Okay.
Now, for my new job, I can do, for instance, depending on, I have to work across two states, as I said.
Yep.
So in one state, I can do both a chest tube and a surgical cricothyrotomy. In the other state on the aircraft, only the nurse can do the chest tube, but I can still do the surgical cricothyrotomy.
Okay.
So the critical care paramedic skills are standardized in, you know, monitoring or putting in chest tubes or doing surgical surgical crikes. But the ability to deploy that skill is based on the individual state rules.
Okay. Is that why you have the double coverage with the nurse and paramedic? Does the nurse fill your skills gaps when they exist?
Yes and no. And from that standpoint, yes. And then also, too, I think it's a good complement to each other, because when you fly to a scene, the paramedic has a little bit more, in theory, the paramedic has a little bit more experience with that.
Yeah.
With just managing, you know.
Managing a
scene.
Yeah.
And then when you fly into an inner facility, the nurse has a little bit more experience with being in that hospital, being in that ICU, accepting some various medications that initially, if you will, the paramedic is not accustomed to in the States into delivering. Yeah. So they're a good complement of each other. Now, obviously, as you
build the advantage skill, to that is that you, wherever you go, you speak the language of where you're going.
Yeah.
I mean, I know sometimes when I turn up in a hospital, I'm lost. Like they speak a different language, they dress funny, it's all very weird, and then they give a handover in a funny format I'm not used to. Whereas if we go to a scene to assist another crew, I definitely feel in my element there.
Right, exactly. But eventually, you know, obviously, for the on the helicopter side of it, that those begin to blur, because as a nurse spends time on the helicopter flying to a scene, just as a paramedic spends time going to the hospital, you know, those skills begin to intertwine. But I think they're just a good complement initially. In theory, the thought is they're each good at the base level skill, but they each bring good things to the specialty.
Yeah.
To the various calls. Yeah. So it's really hard. I think the critical care, like for instance, where I am, even though I have a flight paramedic certification, so I'm a critically care certified, the state does not recognize it. It's on my state license. It's an endorsement.
Ah.
But where I'm going, it's recognized.
Okay. So the critical care qualification varies state to state.
Correct. But if I went and there's a standardized critical care paramedic. There's a couple different curriculums out there floating around. They have different philosophies, but they're all basically getting across the same knowledge and the same skill. It's just that depending on where you go, the state right now, it's being left up to the state as the recognition of those skill level.
Yeah.
Nationally, the national governing body that we have, as I understand it, is beginning to talk about incorporating a critical care paramedic level. But I don't know where that's at, because I'm not one of those guys that pays really close attention to that.
So your national, they regulate the EMTs and paramedics at the moment? Do they, and EMTI?
Their only job is to create the exams to which the knowledge tests you to get a national card. That is it.
Okay.
And then they because we have recently fallen under the trauma surgeon, umbrella. So that's dictating the curriculum. And then the national body just creates the exam. And then you get a card. And then essentially the idea is that I can go to any state and show this card. And then I can pay some money, obviously. And then I can get a state licensure.
Okay.
Is how it works. But there are some, you know, again, other things that go along with that sometimes don't make it that easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
It sounds well. At least you sort of have that unified system. I mean, over here we each new ambulance service you go to work for requires essentially, if you're off the street, you have to reprove your qualifications via a recognition of prior learning program, and then via an induction program, and then via a period of on-road monitoring. Does the regulation system over there streamline that process, or is it still pretty much the same?
No, I just, like, for instance, where I went to work at the ground, when you go into your interview process, you know, they ask you a series of questions, and then they put you through a scenario.
Okay.
And then if you do well on that, then they offer you a position, and then you go into a 3-month basically training program where you're learning the protocols and all that, and you're overseen by what we call field training officers.
Yeah. So that portion's on road?
Yeah, that portion is on road. Okay. Correct. And then at the end of that, as long as you don't, you know, you match all the curricula, you match all the requirements, and you learn all the stuff to basically operate within the job, and we make sure your skill, you can do the, you know, you can really do the skill, then you're off on your own with another paramedic partner. Or we only have, the service I came from, we run dual paramedic. We only have one full-time intermediate.
Okay. Because, here it's a little bit different. We, obviously, you go through the interviewing process, and that has, I think, about 5 levels to it in most services at the moment, through just application testing and then psychiatric evaluation and things like that. And then from there, you go to a training school. They're usually a minimum of 3 weeks up to, I think I've heard of 8 weeks for some services. And then after that, you've got an on-road monitoring period. So for me, that was 12 months on road after my initial.
Oh, wow.
My initial induction. But that's because I was coming straight out of university. It's different if you've already worked in the industry.
Okay.
And then you only do 9 weeks of observed on road time. But if this is your first ambulance job in a 000 response system, then you'll do that 12 months, minimum of 12 month period.
Okay.
Yeah. And I found it to be quite beneficial, because my prior knowledge helped me very little. The physiology and even the anatomy of a 18 to 40 year old male is very different to that of a 80 year old female with multiple comorbidities. Coming out of defense, we didn't really realize how good we had it with some of our patients. They were all easy to cannulate, even when they were profoundly shocked. And they all had a high level of baseline reserve, in terms that they were all quite fit and without serious comorbidities like heart disease or respiratory issues, which we didn't really, like, you don't realize how good you have it in the military.
Right, when you're treating all the 20-somethings with all good veins and good pathology and
yeah, that's like it. That. Where you could just make a 14 your go-to cannula, basically.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Instead of trying to thread that little 22 into the back of Nana's hand or...
Right, exactly. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was definitely a culture shock. How did you find... So obviously you came out of the mountain guiding and things like that. What did you find? Did you find your patient demographic changed significantly between that and 911 systems?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're guiding, not – I didn't really do so much there as much as ski – I mean, it would be easier to talk about the ski patrolling. I mean,
yeah.
Most,
yeah.
Of, mostly with this, I mean, most, I guess where I was, the skiing culture there, most people that do ski there are fairly fit.
Yep.
So the backcountry is what we refer to as in the backcountry. So where they people would ride the lift for some of it and then they would hike. You know, because we used to have to chase down lost skiers too. And those people are generally fairly fit. So you have to be fit. But then when they, you know, they would break bones. And so again, it was kind of a similar, most of the time in that sense, it was the similar thing. You're taking care of fairly, fairly healthy people. But I did have some instances where we, you know, we had to fly a 70-year-old male with a head injury from the scene off the side of the mountain because he was skiing on a very icy day. Probably not or a very cold day with, and we haven't had any snow, and we had a freeze thaw cycle that was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
So then it, you know, it hardened up overnight. So he took a fall, and very competent skier, kind of one of those local guys, been skiing there. Everybody knew who he was, you know.
Yep.
Fell and hit his head, and he did have a helmet on, and but still, he, you know, ended up having a minor brain injury. Luckily, recovered okay, but you know, so that, I guess my point is that's not very normal all the time. So then moving from that to actually treating people in their homes, you know, you begin to see a wide variety of kind of a little bit of that culture shock where you're like, yeah, you know, there isn't a lot you could do without calling for the doc or the paramedic if you had somebody in the, let's say, in one of the lodges that was having difficulty breathing outside of doing oxygen and some pulse oximetry. You know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So it was definitely an eye opener when I started to transition at first, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I've just thought of another ski patrol question. Something that we don't often do here in Australia. We don't really package up people to prevent hypothermia and things like that, or to move them long distances in long periods of exposure, like I suppose you would out that way. So if you have any pearls on that, any tips and tricks, that'd be great.
Yeah, so we used, well, we had a toboggan system is how we move most people, of course, because you and took two people, a person in the front and somebody in the back. And we had two types of toboggans. Actually three. We had a collapse. We had one that broke into two parts that we could carry on our back if we had to go out of bounds to get somebody.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing to have to scare to ski with a one of these thing part of the section on your back. but we used a yellow canvassy type material with two wool blankets on the inside, and then a pad that went inside. So we would burrito wrap the patient with the wool blankets, double wool blankets, and then the canvas over the top with buckles, because, and then we would create a little pocket over their face, because when they were, so the guy in the front, their feet would be down towards the person that was in front of the toboggan, obviously, because when you're going downhill, then their head is uphill.
Yep.
So that makes, obviously, for other reasons at the time, that makes sense. It's also more comfortable because in theory, people can kind of see where they're going. So it makes you feel more comfortable that way. But then we had a device that would go in the sled. If someone had a shoulder dislocation, then they would sit the other way and it would actually prop them up inside the sled, but keep their center of gravity low. At the same time, but it made it more comfortable than laying flat. Obviously, with the shoulder dislocation, that's not always the most comfortable. Plus, you got to remember these people are on the side of a ski hill. So you think riding in the back of an ambulance is bumpy? Try putting somebody in a fiberglass toboggan sled with no shock absorption whatsoever, and you're going to ski them down the mountain over uneven terrain for, you know, what could be, depending on where they are, a while. Till they get to where they need to go. So it's a whole different kind of thing. But yeah, mainly we did the burrito wrap because obviously you don't want to, you were really careful about exposing too much of the injury or too much of the person to get to the immediate injury, because depending on how the weather was or how cold it is, you know, you'd have more problems, obviously, if you don't keep them warm. And they're already cold because they've been sitting on the snow waiting for you to come. So you have to combat that. So really the biggest thing that we did was is get them off the snow as quickly as possible. I mean, almost immediately when we would show up, and then we would treat them in the toboggan and then take off that way. So the wool blanket burrito wrap with the canvas really worked quite well, because that canvas doesn't breathe at all. So it holds the heat in. But other than that, we didn't really do there wasn't too many other tricks, because again, it's that whole thing of being out in the element and your standard basic care for how do we treat hypothermia. Well, one of the biggest things is removing the patient from the environment.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's always on the tip. That's always the quickest. That's always the first thought, you know, so.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's great. That's great. So is there anything else you wanted to have a chat about, or
any
questions you have for me?
Not off the top of my head at the moment. We talked about some stuff beforehand that was really good.
Oh, we did. We'll have to organize a whole nother podcast on that, I think, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's interesting to learn about your system there. It fascinates me, and there's some things about it that I find great, but I don't have any. Thank you for having me. It's been a
pleasure. It's been great to have you as our first international guest. Obviously, this has been the Downstairs Care Out There blog, and this has been JD Graziano and Mitch Thomas. We're going to say bye for now, and look out for us again in a future podcast.